I actually realize that most people don't truly live a healthy life unless they address nutrition as well. So, I mean, we can't out-exercise a unhealthy diet. I think most people know that by now. It takes way longer to run 500 calories off than it does to eat 500 calories.
Hi guys, welcome back to Neff Inspiration, my show on YouTube and as a podcast with me, your host, Stefan Neff. Wow, today an interview that I was really looking forward to because I've got Lisa Franz with me. Lisa is a woman who is absolutely in love with her passion of nutrition. She's a nutritional coach, and I can't wait to deep dive into the many ways how we can become our very best version of ourselves by actually feeding ourselves with what our body really needs. Lisa, welcome to my show.
Thank you so much for having me on, Stefan. Honestly, it's a true pleasure. And as we were saying before we hit record, we have so much to talk about. So I'm truly excited to get into all of that.
Absolutely. And you're not just a nutritional coach, but you're also a digital nomad. You have lived in, well, at least 54 countries now. And with that's beautiful because each and every country has got its own cuisine. And therefore, you are exposed to all these different influences there. Wow. But looking at you, you're absolutely a fit woman. For those of you listening, Lisa is a blonde German girl who just radiates passion, life, etc. Now, most of us who are running around a bit frazzled in our lives, we don't look like you. Now, how did you achieve that and how do you maintain it? How did your passion for nutrition come about?
Really great question. So first of all, my nutritional passion actually followed my passion just for movement. So I mean, I grew up reasonably active. My parents also always liked to take us for hikes, and I was babbling in track and field and swimming in high school already. And then I did a high school year in the US where I was more exposed to team sports like basketball and volleyball and so on. So I have had a passion for movement for a long time. And somehow, for some reason, in my teenage years, I already knew I wanted to have a job that I truly enjoyed and where I wouldn't just make money, but also come home fulfilled. So that was a big focus of mine because I think I saw so many people around me that actually hated their jobs. And because of that, I thought, well, what do I truly like doing? And that at that point was just being physically active. So I enrolled or tried out, so to speak, for the European Sports University in Cologne, and I got accepted, thankfully. And with in my studies there, and with that, I was like, okay, I want to shift a little bit into that direction. Nonetheless, when I finished my university degree, which I actually finished at the Auckland University of Technology in New Zealand, and where you're residing now, because I managed to get a scholarship through the German or European Sports University for Auckland. And so when I finished my studies there, I was kind of like, what do I do with my bachelor's now? Is that because I mean, you study sports and people are like, what do you do with that? I was thinking the same thing. I don't want to be a PE teacher. I don't want to be a personal trainer. What the heck else do I do with that? So I actually shifted a little bit and thought, well, what kind of values are important to me? And at that stage in my life, the value of just having security and something steady, very German thinking, was very important to me. So I actually applied for the New Zealand police. And in New Zealand, for those of you listening, in New Zealand, you don't actually have to be a citizen in order to be able to join the police. In many countries, you have to be a citizen, or at least you have to have had to have lived there for like 10 years or so. In New Zealand, that's not quite the case. You have to have permanent residency, and I did have that already. So anyway, I became a police officer, frontline police officer for several years. But while I was in the police, my head and heart, well, my head a little bit, but my heart certainly not, was not in the job. It was already in the gym. It was already helping people with their nutrition. So the people would still come and gravitate to me with their nutritional and fitness questions. And so after a while, where shift work took its toll on me, so my hormones started to suffer, my mental health started to suffer because in New Zealand police, at least at the time, I think it's still the case, it's a very hard shift roster. So you have two early shifts, you have two late shifts until like 3 a.m., and then you have two night shifts, and then you have 3 days off, one of which you spend sleeping, and then you do the whole thing again. And so my circadian rhythm was completely destroyed after a few years, and I just really knew I needed to get out of this. And so my thought was, okay, I want to do something with health and nutrition and fitness again, but what could that be? Because I knew I wanted to be boss of my own timetable and everything else. So I actually just looked into online personal training. At that stage, that was like 2016, 17, that didn't really exist to the extent that it does today. Like it started building up and so on. And so I took some additional certifications and actually got a coach myself, a nutrition coach, and an online coach for my training as well, because I just wanted to see how do they operate. And then, yeah, after a while, I started building up my business on the side. And when I left New Zealand Police in 2019, I had already established a good base with clients that would give me
Nice.
still that feeling of security, so that I wouldn't be too afraid of leaving a job completely and shifting.
Wow. A lot of personal growth involved in that journey, and a lot of challenges involved in that journey as well. I love how you pointed out the destruction of circadian rhythm, and in turn, the massive impact it has on our health. We know that just from shift work in its own right. Add to that the uncertainty of your job, and the rise, I guess, of physical violence and the change in our society that occurred also over that period of time. Nowadays, 2024, as we're recording that, we see probably, I don't want to see record high incidences of violence towards retail staff, towards filling stations or petrol station staff. We see a change in our society here that is strange and is very hard. And I often wonder how all those lovely women and men in our police force are dealing with it. And you just gave me the answer there. It is a self-limiting kind of profession, so to speak. Wow. And your nutrition, though, and in all fairness, your focus on exercise and your focus on nutrition, both of them are the key things to actually let you survive in a difficult environment. And here you are. Despite all that, you felt challenged. Despite all that, despite your knowledge, which set you probably ahead of 99% of people, even you suffered. And I think that is so important to realize, isn't it? Wow.
Yeah,
Okay.
it really gave me a lot of empathy for anybody working in shift work, not just police workers, but like any first responders, but also, hospital staff, et cetera. Or literally, it can also be your gas station attendant, doesn't matter. Shift work really is hard. I do think that they made it particularly hard on us by giving us that rotating shift roster.
True.
Many countries or jobs at least give you something where, for 3 months, 2 months, you're doing the night shift. And while that sounds horrible, and it most certainly is, at least you have something where you can settle in a little bit and have a little bit of something where your circadian rhythm can get attached to it. I will not lie, it has taken me probably 2, 3 years after finishing shift work to restore somewhat of a regular sleeping pattern. There throw in some other things there. I was overtraining at the time, actually, to be honest. My ex-husband was snoring heavily, so that didn't help my sleep either. But aside from that, even though, as you said, I'm so aware of what we need to do in order to sleep better. So, for example, I made sure to cut off caffeine at the right time. I made sure not to use any screens right before going to sleep. I made sure to sleep in a dark, cold, room. I like all these things that I now teach my clients that's going to help you with better sleep. It still didn't negate the one really important thing, which I now tell people to try and have a somewhat regular bedtime, if at all possible. Yes, there's some leeway room where you can say, 30 minutes plus minus, or even an hour on the weekends. But that is a very well-known fact that if people suffer from any kind of sleeping disorder, one of the first things practitioners usually address with them is, let's determine a bedtime. It doesn't matter if that's 12 o'clock or if that's 9 o'clock, but one time where you aim to be in bed. And then the same with your rising time, actually. And those two things, having those two anchors, is some of the most helpful thing that we can do. And then on top of that, if we add some cues through daylight, so let's just say within an hour or two after rising, we try to go outside for a little bit, using dimmed light in the evening. Like, as you can tell, I was aware of all of these things. Nonetheless, it took me quite a long time to restore a regular circadian rhythm. And I think that that's just makes it so clear how important staying on top of that and making sleep a priority really is. And I think it's not talked about enough. Many people sleep with their phones in their bedroom, or it's the first and the last thing that they see before and after they go to sleep. And how much of an impact that truly has on our system. And then we wonder why we're not sleeping well as a society, or why we're waking up regularly, and all these kinds of things.
Beautiful. You nailed it and you summarized it so beautifully. These are all little things that we can do. And sometimes, because they are little things, we think, it's, who cares? It has no impact. Each and every one of these things you have mentioned in isolation probably hasn't such a big impact, but we don't do things in isolation. So you have got actually everything coming together. And on the one hand, that means, oh my God, this can be difficult to all address. But then again, with a systematic approach, once you actually learn what to do, it makes it quite easy. And then suddenly, because you're ticking all these things off, you get a synergistic approach. So one plus one makes three. And I think that's the power that we have. And I love what you said earlier. You can't outrun the fork. And people have tried. People have tried. There are some influencers out there, some absolute gym mad people, really, who train the whole day, literally. And they actually tried to. They tried to eat 10,000 calories, and they tried to train 10,000 calories in 24 hours. And many of them were unable actually to do it, despite the fact that they have virtually non-stop trained the whole day.
You know what? I just wanted to throw in a small anecdote here, because I read a book not too long ago, and it's called, oh, now I'm blanking the name, but anyway, it's by Ross Edgley, I think, something with resilience, the edge of resilience or so. So Ross Edgley, and he's nowadays, he's calling himself a hybrid athlete. So he does a lot of extreme endurance things and so on. So for instance, and this particular book elaborates about how he swam around the UK. So around the UK for 180 something days straight. He didn't touch land throughout this time. So he swam 12 hours a day and slept for 12 hours per day for about half a year, literally. And of course, he was consuming a lot of calories because he knew he had to in order to keep his body afloat, literally, and to prevent any kind of illness. But the interesting thing, because my dad is an endurance enthusiast, and he's always like, oh, I biked a lot today, and so I can eat XYZ. And so I always tell him, that's not quite the case, Dad. And so I gave him this book to read. And in the book, there's actually the statistics and like everything that Ross measured. And so he gained 15 kilos in the course of a year, of that half a year, where he was swimming for half of the day. So literally swimming 12 hours per day, and he gained 15 kilos of fat and he lost 5 kilos of muscle mass. So let that sink in. This is like, no, don't quote me 100% on these exact numbers, but that is a lot of body fat to be gained over the course of half a year while swimming literally half of the day. So anybody listening who's doubting what you said prior to that, please read this book. It's a great book to begin with. And secondly, this is going to open your eyes.
It's beautiful. Exactly. And wow. I mean, in all fairness, he wouldn't have had a bit of salmon on a salad. Okay. So, no, he would
No.
have had Mars bars. He would have had whatever. I mean, if you look at, a
Literally,
pack of
yes.
butter, when, if you
No,
look
and he
at.
was very well aware of it. He very intentionally ate, 7 to 10,000 calories every single day. So very, very intentional.
Having said that, that's a little bit of a difficult one because he also swam in cold water. So therefore, for his body to actually defend himself against hypothermia, he needs to burn extra calories.
Exactly.
So there were other factors in play. Yet you would have expected now, especially because of those challenges, he needs to eat more. What a beautiful, beautiful anecdote there! Wow. And here we are. I mean, in an ideal world, calories in, calories out, for many people, well, that's what it is all about. Having said that, we know that is not the case. There are so many, many factors that affect weight gain, weight loss, starting from genetics to, far more important, the epigenetics, the stress, all the hormones, all the beautiful balance of ghrelin, of leptin, of hormones that are so important for our weight loss journey for most of us. When I say weight loss, of course there are other people who struggle for weight to gain it, but that is the minority, a small minority in our society nowadays. When I say our society, I'm referring to the US, I'm referring to much of Europe. I think UK and US are now on tight as far as the amount of very big people, obese people, and super morbidly obese. So, I mean, we are talking about the 400, 500 pound people that are walking. So we are facing a huge epidemic. How is that in other countries? I mean, you've had the privilege of traveling, of living now in South America and Bolivia. What is the incidence of obesity and severe obesity there?
Really, really great question. And as a matter of fact, I was just discussing like systemic influences with somebody yesterday, and we were talking about how poorly constructed many, particularly American cities, but I would argue also some places in New Zealand are, in the sense of walking possibilities versus driving possibilities. And for instance, in the US, it's just so common to take your car everywhere, to have everything delivered to your doorstep, to basically never have to leave the house. You can scooch from the bed into a chair and roll on your chair to your desk, and from there you roll over to, like, literally you do not have to leave the house. And that's quite sad, truly, because if I look at the activity that's forced onto you for day-to-day living here in Bolivia or Colombia specifically as well, you have to move in order to get to places, and it's just much more built into our lives. I would argue that in Europe we're still quite fortunate, or at least in Germany and many other places like that, we're still quite fortunate that daily physical activity is quite prominent. For example, I was very curious how many steps my mom takes on a daily basis, because she likes to garden. She also takes her bicycle to go to work, and she's she's like a busy bee, like always on her feet. There's good and bad parts to that, but anyway, so I was like, Mom, I would love for you to wear my Fitbit, my Apple Watch or whatever for a couple of days. And without even trying, she gets 12,000 steps per day. Now tell that to someone who lives in the US who gets on average 2 to 3,000 steps. So
Oh, really?
that is where. No wonder. Of course, in Germany, we also have a rising obesity crisis a little bit coming up, but not to the extent of the US yet. So, to answer your question, here in Bolivia and in Colombia, where I was just up until a couple of weeks ago, the number or the obesity is also on the rise, unfortunately, due to more and more places like McDonald's and other fast food restaurants popping up. Yes, for sure. But in general, their portion sizes are still smaller. In general, they're walking to a lot more places. In general, also, and that's not necessarily a main contributor, but they do have more of the lunch as the main meal. And breakfast is a little bit smaller, dinner is a little bit smaller. And in between that, you work and you walk and you do stuff. And it's not this whole I'm thinking from one meal to the next and kind of like food is the main thing of the day and everything else is just kind of sprinkled in between. It's not like that. They do also still have the wonderful aspects of culture where on Sundays, you do come together as a family and you have a wonderful feast together with a lot of food, but it's shared and it's shared in company and it's shared over the course of 3, 4, 5 hours versus what I have seen and experienced in the US, where it's like you eat your humongous meal and then you leave right away and drive to your next drive-through or so to pick up your sugar coffee. And anyone listening, I love the US. I have a lot of clients in the US. My best friend lives in the US. So I'm certainly not badgering it. I'm just saying that it doesn't make your life easier. That being said, also, just at the beginning of the year, I traveled to Brazil for a friend's wedding. And that was after several months in Colombia. So just being exposed to the Colombian culture. And I landed in São Paulo and I was like, wow, there is actually very, very big people here. And it was almost like a shock. So even within the Latin countries, there is very big differences. How urban are you living? How rural are you living? In which country are you living? What kind of access do they have? So for example, in Brazil, I mean, there's a Starbucks and McDonald's and whatever on every single corner. Here in Bolivia, McDonald's does not exist. Not a single one exists here. No, it's literally that there's no McDonald's. There's four Starbucks in the entire country. So it just tells you that there's still, of course, again, comes with some disadvantages in certain fields as well. But it's very country dependent. But if our environment is conducive to a higher calorie intake, we're lazy by nature. Humans are lazy by nature. So why wouldn't we take that easy access thing? I totally empathize for anyone who is in a habit of going through a drive-through because they're very busy. So yeah, it's a very difficult topic.
Having said that, I now play devil's advocate. First, we said you can't outrun the fork, even with extreme measures. On the other hand, the very first thing you said that people are more active, and you were referring to the step count in daily life. Isn't the step count just the tiniest little bit? Doesn't even matter in theory compared with the amount of food we eat? Or
Oh no, I love that you're pointing that out because I realize the hypocrisy of what I've been saying or how we're talking. But I guess two points to this. So number one, NEAT, which is what it's referred to, and so your non-exercise activity thermogenesis, all the kind of activity that you do that is not really conscious or purposeful exercise. So that might be your gesturing, your standing, you're cleaning the house or the apartment, the gardening that I was referring to. It actually makes up a bigger amount of your calorie expenditure than what people think. I mean, depending on how much it is or not, but it can make up to 20% of your total daily calorie expenditure,
Absolutely.
something around
Absolutely.
that. And the beautiful thing is also that it's super adaptive. So that's actually, research shows more and more that that's actually one of the things that adapts quite a bit depending on if you're in a calorie deficit, so eating less than what your body actually needs or more. So if anybody listening here has ever done a diet, they might have noticed that after a while they were not quite as inclined to stand as much. They were probably a little bit more likely to sit. They probably didn't really want to take the stairs all the apparently anymore. So it's just a more of an intrinsic thing versus if you have a surplus of calorie or enough food available, then you're just a little bit more inclined to be active to a certain level. Of course, when you get to an obese stage, that's not the case anymore, but that's a different topic. But yeah, so it makes up for a higher percentage than people realize. And B, what my point was with also the activity is just that food is not quite as much of a focus in these countries. Like if you have to
True.
between your breakfast and your lunch, if you actually have to like go out from this place to another and you have to carry your rice from here to there and work for it more almost in a physical manner, it's not like you're just thinking from one meal to the next versus if it's always available to you and you have the financial means and food is on every corner and so on. Like literally many of the clients that I work with, they just say they call it food noise. Food is always on your mind. You're always thinking about what's the next thing. So you finish your meal and you're almost thinking about, okay, what do I have to drink next? Or where's my gum? And then from the gum, you go to another little snack. And so it's constantly something in your mouth. And that is also for your hunger signals, not ideal because you don't get into that habit of like, I'm eating, I'm finishing my meal satiated, not full, but satiated. And now I'm doing other stuff. I'm able to focus on work. I'm able to focus on having this wonderful conversation here with you. And then in a few hours' time, my stomach is going to let me know, okay, you're hungry again. Sure, is it time to eat? Okay, let's eat something. And then that's how you go about your day. And the only really time where food is a focus here, at least I get the perception, is when it is at these beautiful family get-togethers where you put love and time into the meals, and it's not just like, okay, let's get this down in 15, 20 minutes.
A beautiful answer. And I would add one more fact to it. We have realized in recent years that the muscle is actually a endocrine organ. It is actually an organ that has quite a bigger role than we initially thought of just, well, muscle contracts, yeah, and it needs from some glucose from now and then. No, there is so much more to musculature. And indeed, we understand nowadays that the amount of muscle mass that you have is directly linked to longevity, to actually living your life truly to the fullest. So, one of the things that are so worthwhile to note is that many cultures enjoy their food and then go for a walk. There is some exercise linked, and exercise is a silly word here. Activity is probably a better word. There's some physical activity linked to the food. And you can actually go one step further. If you want to lose weight, apart from obviously intermittent fasting and fasting in its own right, which I strongly believe in, if you just look at what you eat just before you eat, do 2 minutes of exercise that affects as many muscles in your body as possible. Some squats and some push-ups for 2 minutes. That's all you need to do. What you do is you work your muscles, your glucose transporters, so that those little pathways that try to get the glucose out of the bloodstream into the muscles. They are saying, okay, come on, I need food here. We've just worked out. So now the moment you eat something, instead of it all going to the liver and being some of it metabolized to fat, they say, no, actually, no, here, straight to the muscle, please. And that's beautiful. It's a tiny little
Yeah.
hack, but if you make that in your day, if you put that into your day, then A, it makes you feel good because you've taken action. There's the psychology around you actually looking out for yourself. Soon it becomes normal and you don't even think about it unless someone comments, hey, what are you doing? It's lunchtime. Yeah, exactly. It's lunchtime. Push, 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 push. And it's fantastic. Yeah, it's so little things. So yes, Often people think, let's only focus on exercise. And then other people think, no, let's focus only on nutrition. How about we combine the best of all worlds?
It's so wonderful, and I love that you threw the importance of muscle in there. And I'm very happy that it's becoming more of a well-known or spoken about thing. And I don't know if that's just the world that I live in, but particularly
I guess
one
so.
of the physicians that I admire as well, her name is Dr. Gabrielle Lyon. She always says we're not necessarily over fat. We as a society in general, we don't necessarily have excess fat, but we're under muscled. She always calls muscle, as you said, the organ of longevity and just the most important organ that we really have. And most people don't look at muscle as an organ, as you pointed out also. So I do think what strength training or any kind of resistance training that builds muscle and also has is that even though it doesn't necessarily quote unquote burn that many calories in the pursuit of it. So in a strength training session, even though I might be going hard in the gym, I might burn like 200, 300 calories. And that might sound quite shocking to some people listening. And if your Apple Watch or whatever tells you otherwise, tells you that you're burning 1,000 calories, don't listen to it. These trackers are not accurate by any means. But so I don't want people listening to think, well, what's the point of doing it then? The point is, going back to what we said a minute ago also, the point is to decrease the body fat percentage. So simply getting not so tied or hung up on the scale weight anymore, but thinking about how can I lose body fat while increasing or at least maintaining my muscle mass and training, but the right kind of training. So not just doing endurance work, but also specifically doing resistance training is the best way to send your body the signal to do so, to build muscle or at least hold on to it. And of course, there are some nutritional strategies to do that also. But yes, the postprandial, post meal walks, I'm such a big fan of them. I used to think that they're mostly beneficial for digestion, but I 100% agree with you after looking a little bit more into the research that it's so beneficial also for blood sugar and hunger regulation. And when you get into the habit of that, of like, okay, I finished my meal, I'm gonna go for even just a 5 minute, 10 minute walk. And actually, some studies show that even just standing as opposed to staying seated post meals is better for your blood sugar regulation. So, but anyway, going back to it, you're going to forget that you possibly want a dessert, because oftentimes people finish a meal and they're like, oh, I just need something sweet. I hear that all the time. I just need something sweet. If you go for that walk and you come back from your 5 to 10 minute walk, you're gonna have forgotten that you wanted that sweet at the time, and you're gonna be able to dive into your work. So I love that notion. I also used to believe it's just about the daily total steps. And yeah, it doesn't matter if you get a 30 minute walk in or if you get 3 10 minute walks in, but because of the blood sugar regulation reasons that you mentioned, I truly think that splitting up your walks is actually even more beneficial. Of course, that being said, adherence and what somebody can do is always trumps what's optimal. So if someone's listening is like, I can't go for a walk after my breakfast and my lunch, but I can go for a longer walk after dinner, please, by all means, do that.
Perfect. I love it. It's the consistency over the day. And as I said, it is so hard to, well, you mentioned so many things, for Christ's sake. In the first instance, I love your focus on Fitbit, or I've got a Garmin watch, and I have that linked with other gadgets. So there are some powerful tools that give you a number. But that number is not necessarily right, just as much as, for example, many of the food trackers underestimate the calories that are in food, and many of the exercise trackers overestimate the amount of calories that you burn. So let's be quite clear, and that's often 20% or even higher, depending upon what quality thing you have got. So let's be quite clear about that. What I also want to point out, whilst you are right that a strenuous session in the gym might burn 500 calories in that time frame, what it, however, also does, it keeps the basic metabolic rate, that the way that your body burns energy, keeps that up for a few hours. And so therefore, again, if you were to do multiple sessions over the day, shorter sessions, that continues over the day, and you teach your body, hey, come on, let's get active. And I think that is a beautiful thing. So it's really a lifestyle. And we are not talking, when we're talking nutrition, we are not talking diets. Diet is a shit thing. 95% of diets fail. But food plans, a conscious implementation of food as a nutritional thing that sustains life, and bring that into your life as part of life sustaining. Now that will win hands down. You can't not change for the better if you were to implement a sensible food plan. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would 100% agree, and I see the same thing. Like any kind of diet, and I don't just see I to people listening when I introduce myself. Sometimes I say that the reason I got into nutrition was also because I've struggled through very many diets myself, finding the way that I'm eating now. So I tried paleo, try low carb and whatever, and all of these, what they had in common was that I felt restricted. They might have worked for an extended period of time, might have given me a little bit of result, not to the extent that I wanted, but I felt restricted. I just always was thinking about my cheat weekend and about okay, today is off the plan, but I'm starting again on Monday. And now one of my main missions is to show people that sustainability and not and having that feeling of food freedom that's free of that food noise that I was talking about earlier is really, really the key to maintaining something long term. And in my opinion, there are two crucial points to that. The first one being, let's overall focus more on what we should be having more of, as opposed to always thinking about, I can't have that, I can't have this, I can't have so. So what I mean by that is, what should be on my plate? Think about what should be on your plate and don't think so much about what should not be on your plate. So what should be on your plate is probably more vegetables and more protein, so more whole food sources, more things that are less processed. So a little bit less bread, a little bit less pasta, a little bit less sugar, and all these kind of things. And things that are essentially one or maybe two ingredient kind of foods. So, yeah, your vegetables, some fruit, some meat and fish, and so on, if you choose to be an omnivore, some eggs, these kinds of things, potatoes. So, literally, what should you have more of? Whole foods. And then the second part is still not depriving yourself of these perhaps a little bit more processed foods or the foods that you're craving that also fill your heart and your soul. We all have these things that, for us Germans, or at least for me, part of that is bread. I do love bread. I love a good pretzel or bread source, or even just my grandma's baking. If I think of, you could, if someone told me you can ha never ever have that again, that would be hard for me. That would break my heart. And so I do want to encourage people and teach my clients as well to have these things in moderation, not to have them on a daily, on a regular basis. But if
Absolutely.
I say to myself, hey, 2, 3 times per week, I am going to allow myself a high quality sourdough bread. Or if my grandma bakes for me, I'm going to have a piece of cake. Or if I go out for date night, I might share some dessert with somebody. But making it about the experience and slowing down for it and enjoying it truly, as opposed to shoving in the muffin on my drive to work and not even realizing that that's what I'm doing every single day. And it adds up because it's a habit. So those are two very different things. And I think if we focus on the whole foods that we want to have more of, and how can I incorporate some treats on occasion, but making it special and making it something I'm truly enjoying, if you do these two things, you're going to get a very, very long way with your nutrition and feel good about it as well.
Love it. Absolutely love it. And I think, having said that, we are falling prey to some very nasty, insidious influences out there, because there is so much confusion out there. In theory, we all know that we're probably eating a lot of shit. Yet, when you then look at official guidance, look at the food pyramid, for example. In 1992, they sort of really focused on food pyramid and lots of grains down there, lots of sugar, basically. And you think, what the hell? And we think, what the hell now? But then it was official guidance. You know, the cleverest people of the clever people came together and gave us this thing, like the Ten Commandments given down from God. And in reality, nowadays, we realize that was a heap of bullshit, and that was driven by big organizations. That was essentially really, really probably the start of the obesity epidemic that led us down there. We moved away from more healthier eating patterns, and we discarded things that didn't fit the money-making kind of scheme. And I sound as if I had to wear a tinfoil hat, but regrettably, guys, if you're worried, if you're wondering, is he going nuts? Or please look into that, and you will realize that unfortunately, much of the nutritional advice that is given nowadays, and more so in the past, was actually purely led by financial interests. Would you agree with that?
The sad thing about this is that they were able to position it in a way. So, for example, I think some of what you're referring to is also the Keys, Angel Keys study or Seven Countries study or whatever, where they supposedly demonstrated that saturated fats and so on are the root cause of all evil for heart disease, and what you should really be eating is more sugar and sugar and sugar, and we're taking all the fat out of the healthy fats out of the diet. But anyway, they were able to position it in a way where it seemed like it was backed up by science because they had done some studies on it. And so if you even some of the people that became inquisitive of like, okay, is there any foundation, any basis to this recommendation here? And then they were like, oh yeah, look, here's the study. And the 10 different doctors are now positioning it in the way that, yes, you should be having this. And many people, so for example, my grandma and still my parents as well, and I was raised that way, they had that high respect of anybody who was in a white cloak. So that is basically you have God, and then right underneath that you have the doctors. Anything a doctor says, doesn't matter what it is, you do that because they know what they're talking about. And you would know better than I how little nutritional education physicians actually receive. I mean, I don't know the exact number, it probably depends on where you study and so on as well. But reality is, A, many physicians themselves have probably the worst health habits ever. Like, I know
Correct.
many doctors that smoke, that don't sleep properly, that don't exercise, like all these things. Number two, they probably don't know either about the right macro distribute. They might just say like, oh, okay, you have some heart conditions, let's just cut out meat completely. Or so that might be the first recommendation, because that's what they learned 40, 50 years ago in school. It's not like you're continuously educated on. So I 100% agree with you on what you said. I also think social media is not necessarily helping us nowadays, though, disseminating or being able to pick out the right information, because you have your vegan crew and then you have your carnivore, and everybody is like, I've had success with this, so this was why it should work for everyone. And the truth of the matter is, when it comes to nutrition, very few things are so individualized as nutrition. And because you can't just, you see someone who lost weight and then you think that must be the way to go. That person was perhaps on keto, and so you're jumping on keto, realizing that you're actually doing a lot better with more carbs in your system because you have a higher intensity training program or whatever. The next person loves intermittent fasting and has lost 50 pounds on inter with intermittent fasting, and you yourself are trying to force yourself to not have anything until midday, although you're actually working out in the morning and you're kind of cutting yourself in the leg by not having any food afterwards. So it's really difficult. And then throw into the mix with that also these people can probably pick out a study somewhere that backs up whatever claim that they're making. So the carnivore is like, oh, here is a study that shows that being carnivore is superior to being vegan. And then the vegan comes, but here are three studies that show that being vegan is super. So it doesn't make it easy, because even if you feel like I'm going to trust what the research says, it can be very confusing.
Absolutely. Smoking does not harm your health, signed Dr. Marlboro. Nowadays, we are lucky because there are conflict of interest statements with many of the research that is being published, and we can see who has funded a particular research. But regrettably, there's quite some evidence out there that those studies that were funded by an industry are typically 80, 90, I've forgotten the exact thing, but I mean, highly positive towards an hypothesis or an outcome, whilst if they are not funded, that changes quite significantly. So therefore, you can find a study that basically proves absolutely anything. And only because there is no study available, those people who say, no, I only believe in evidence-based medicine. To the best of my knowledge, there is no study that proves that parachutes save lives. That has never been proven. So here you go. I still wear a parachute if I given the choice. So there you go. So it's hard.
It really is hard. And what I want to add to this as well is that we underestimate, I think, often the power of placebo or pre-existing belief that we have towards something. And we all grow up with something. So whether you grow up around a family that loves carbs more than fats, or whether you grow up around a family that's very active or whatever, like you have these preconceived notions. And then maybe it depends on who tells you what as well. So you hear about this keto thing from your very best friend that you trust 100,000%, and suddenly you believe this is the way to go, and it literally influences your physiological response when you're eating something, what you believe about that food, versus if you would have heard that exact same thing from someone you hate, and then maybe after that you watch three or four reels that go against that too. And then you listen to a podcast that's against that too, and then you try keto, very different physiological response. So
Very good.
there are actually, yeah, you might be familiar with this study I just read recently. It was super interesting in regards to a milkshake. So they had this study. They wanted to show that literally your hunger hormones, so your ghrelin, your leptin, and so on, respond differently depending on what you believe. So they had this milkshake, let's just say it had 300 calories, had some protein in there, whatever. But the one group was told this milkshake is super low calorie. It's just literally just protein powder, 100 calories, go nuts. It's very healthy for you. It has some micronutrients in there, some vitamins added, blah, blah. The other group was told this is a milkshake. It's from like Dairy Queen, has 600 calories. It's quite fattening, so just enjoy it slowly because blah, blah, blah. They measured the physiological response and they saw that this exact same milkshake, which actually only had 300 calories, had different responses depending on what you were told. So the one group had a higher leptin response, the other group a lower one. It blew my mind because it's like we're so, and I mean I would have responded just the same way. I'm just as gullible as the next person, but it's just so impressive, like what our mind does to our physiology and the other way around as well.
So interesting. So if we now extrapolate from here, if you were to say, I am fat. The response from your body will actually be, yeah, you're fat. And if you're even worse, if you say, why am I so fat? Well, your body will give you about 20 reasons why you're so fat. And you get the same with, why am I such a failure? Well, okay, first of all, you suppose that you are a failure. You're not even questioning that. And it's the same with the I'm fat. So on the flip side, if you say, I am open to exercise, I am interested in healthy food. I am eating healthy. Just the same thing, yet you have not yet changed anything. You haven't touched a salad leaf. I think the response to of your body will be very, very different. And that's where the power of the mind comes in, the power of the affirmations, the power of you educating yourself and starting tiny little habits every single day that will change the whole setup. And those tiny little habits, those 10 affirmations or 30 affirmations that you're actually telling yourself maybe 3 times a day, in its own right, what are they? 2 minutes in your day? But the flow-on effects, the bang for the buck will be so much more, just based upon the positivity that you influence, and that then has flow-on effects that you maybe do those 10 push-ups. Oh, push-ups for many of us, that's a dream out there. I mean, even that walk up the stairs, maybe just, instead of taking a lift at work, maybe you choose to walk the stairs. That is a direct flow-on effect of you thinking in a different way. So
I
there
love,
is
yeah, I love that direction.
we have so much power, and we have got so many choices. So if you think, oh my God, I'm so overwhelmed, no surprise, and I welcome you to the fold, because we all are overwhelmed. There's so much information out there, for crying out loud, and as you said, often misleading, often very much colored towards one direction, and it's hard to make sense of it. But I think there are some very common things that we all can do. I swear on the G bombs. I swear on the rainbow. The G bombs, that is not a curse word, a swear word. What are your mnemonics? What are your things that you teach your
Oh,
clients?
well, no, I love that you're taking it or have taken us into this direction because truly, I mean, without our mind being in the right state, nothing is going to be sustainable. So if we tell ourselves weight loss is really hard, everyone in my family is overweight, gaining weight over the holidays is just inevitable, everyone gains weight over the holidays. That's what's going to happen. Number one, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy because you're leaving a little bit of a door open for yourself to like actually not follow through on what you want to do. But number two, it's part of your identity. Like if you're telling yourself, I have a hard time losing weight, so I'm just gonna stay unhealthy and big because everyone in my family is that way, you're going to But like you're going to match your actions to match that belief. That's just how we work. And so oftentimes, as weird as that sounds and feels as well, we have to work backwards. So you actually have to, as you said, start with the mantra, even though it feels unauthentic. I so often hear like, but I don't believe that yet. Why should I even say that in order to get yourself to believe it eventually? And it's not going to happen overnight. It's not even going to happen in a week or a month. But if you think about how long you have been telling yourself that you're fat and ugly and unsuccessful, if that's been your reality for the last 20 years, you can't override that limiting belief overnight. But if you keep telling yourself over and over again what you want to believe in the future, it's going to happen as well. And I'm a huge fan of having visual reminders as well. So having those is little sticky notes in places, or even changing your screensaver to something cheesy, or having that little fridge magnet that's motivating you to do something, as dumb as they seem to people sometimes. And even if you just look at it out of the corner of your eye, it's going to become part of your reality more and more than if you're not reminded of that on a regular basis. If you just journal on it in the morning, your 2 minute morning meditation, and then oh yeah, whatever, and you go about the rest of your day and you forget about it. I mean, that's a good start, don't get me wrong, but it's the more frequent reminders we can have throughout the day of who we want to become, the more helpful it's going to be. And I'll give you a silly example as well. And so I used to struggle, or well, going back even further, I've always admired people that have pretty nails. Sounds super shallow, but every time I saw like a woman with wonderful nails, I asked her, where did you get them done? Or wonderful color, and it just looks like someone's taking care of themselves. I've always admired that. That being said, I grew up with a mom who has never once in her life done her nails. I every now and then, 2, 3 times a year, attempted to do my own nails, and I actually bit my nails for a bit as well. And so horrible. And in April this year, I was just like, I'm sick and tired of this. Especially here in Latin America, everyone has these beautiful nails. You see these gorgeous Latinas, of course, always wonderfully dressed as well, and they have nice nails. And then there's me, and I was almost ashamed of my nails. And so in that moment, I decided I'm the person who takes care of her nails. Since then, this was April. Since then, I have been getting my nails done on a regular basis. Again, this I know how dumb this sounds to people probably out there, but every time that little voice inside of my head kept popping up that told me, oh, Lisa, you don't have time to go to the nail salon. Lisa, you don't, you're not worth it. This month, money's a little bit tight. Don't get your nails done. Lisa, you can just do that yourself. You don't need to you go there. I said to myself, I'm the kind of person who gets her nails done. And I tell it to my clients as well as a form of transferring that over to nutrition, because if we tell ourselves, I'm the kind of person that values her health, I'm the kind of person who works out 2, 3 times per week, I'm the kind of person who chooses to eat well, I'm the kind of person who can eat more, all these kind of things, if you think of yourself, I am that kind of person,
Beautiful.
then you're gonna have to stick with that. And yeah, as dumb as that example might
Well,
sound, for me, it has worked to change my weird little habit.
it's a beautiful, beautiful little thing, but to actually conquer this quotation mark little thing, it wasn't a little thing for you. It was something in the back of your mind, and you actually challenging yourself and following through is such a boost for your self-confidence. It's such a boost for that. So whilst we said earlier, let's not focus on the weight too much, still you actually being more active and looking at your step count and thinking, oh, I'm actually getting closer to the 10,000 every day. And even if I today was not, I'll tell you what, I'm going for a walk now and making up for it. You are showing up for yourself. You're jumping on your scale and you're suddenly realizing, wow, okay, I have lost a kilogram. Okay, that's good. These are all little wins, and we are so bad in celebrating our wins. We're very good in beating ourselves up with regards to those things that we have done wrong. But those 99% of the, well, for some of us, 99%, for others, maybe okay, there's 70% that you did right on the day. Let's celebrate that. Let's actually be there positive. I think this positivity has huge flow-on effects. So we've already touched upon so much that works together. The power of sleep, the power of stress reduction, the power of improving your circadian rhythm, strengthening it, the power of the daily activity, not necessarily exercise, but activity in its own right. But when we look at food, food as truly sustaining our health and bringing out the best in us, then I would say that 80 to 90% of the food that we get in the supermarket should not be called food. Probably in some items that the cardboard packaging has more nutritional value than what you actually find inside the cardboard. So if we accept that, and many of us are getting better in reading labels and being aware of what we're putting in our mouths, where are the low-hanging fruit? Where are those things that get us most bang for the buck if we were to now try to just put one little change in every 3 to 4 days? Or even if you want to be slower, every week we make one tiny change with regards to our nutrition. Where are the low-hanging fruit?
Yeah, I would really take it back to one of the things that I said earlier in the sense of whole foods. So if we just start with, I want to put a handful of vegetables into every meal, or if it's your breakfast, a handful of fruit, whatever. That's a great place to start for this week and or next week. Then layering on top of that, once it's become kind of consistent, that you're like, okay, I'm gonna add the goal of having about a palm size or maybe more of a lean protein source on my plate as well. And already, if we think about what we're gonna have more of, we automatically eat less of the other junk. So not even thinking about, okay, how do I get rid of all the cardboard food that you mentioned, but thinking, okay, I've got my veggies, I've got my fruit. Now that's kind of a habit. I'm going to layer in having at least a palm-sized portion of a lean protein source. So in your breakfast, that could also be low-fat Greek yogurt. You can include some protein powder if you really want, if it's something sweet. Nothing wrong with eggs or egg white mixture there in the morning either. People always think breakfast needs to be sweet. It can also be savory. You can have some leftovers from the day before. Perfect. But yeah, otherwise in your lunch, some chicken, some fish, some great whole food protein sources there, and then going from there. I think that would be the two low-hanging fruits that I would tackle first: veggies for your fiber and your micronutrients, and then your protein sources.
Beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. That's exactly my answer. And it is important that we understand we've got really three big macronutrient group. And I would say nowadays, actually, I personally have, I call it four. We have got the fat, the protein, the carbohydrates, and fiber. Fiber is only something that we more recently realized how important it is for our gut microbiome, and that is really what feeds it, but also which binds toxins, also which helps us to be more regular, etc. It has so many so beautiful benefits out of it. Now, if you were to look at the maybe more traditional free, the protein, fat, and carbohydrates, if you look at protein, there are essential amino acids. And they're important. Without them, if we don't have them in our food, our body really suffers. There are essential fatty acids. And again, we need that. Our brain is based upon fat. So we need it all for the function of our body. Now, then there are the essential carbohydrates, which are none. There are no essential carbohydrates. Okay. Just let that sink in. Okay. Your big bowl of commercially produced pasta in a cheese sauce. About that. So I think there is so much that we can learn. So if we were to focus on vegetables, which give us carbohydrates, but in a far more complex version than the ultra processed foods, which are typically very easily accessible, often fructose and glucose together, sort of sugar laden. These are two different kettles of fish, wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, I mean, those food groups, 100%, even just picturing it like that and knowing what is part of which is one of the reasons I am actually big on, at least at some stage in your life, tracking food content. So I don't think everybody needs to be recording and weighing out their food every single day for the rest of their lives. Absolutely not. But committing to saying, like, let's say, okay, for a couple of weeks, I'm actually going to look into recording my food in any kind of app. Nowadays, it's so easy. It can be MyFitnessPal, My Macros, whatever. Like, there's a gazillion free ones out there. So that you at least learn what is in my food. Because I don't know about you, but before I learned more about it, I thought, okay, peanut butter is a great protein source. If it's mostly fats, there's a teeny bit, tiny bit of protein in there.
Correct.
Then, okay, sometimes here, beans are a great protein source. Actually, beans are carbs, fats, and protein, but not a great protein source. So it's just eye-opening. And the other eye-opening aspect to that for me also was that things where I just thought they're healthy, yes, they might be healthy, but I didn't realize how high in calories they were. So for example, again, going back to the nut butters or so, I just thought almond butter on my oats, that's a great addition, healthy fats and so on. You always hear monounsaturated fats, you should have more of that. Didn't realize that my heaped tablespoon that I would have on there had an extra 250 calories. Of course, it tasted good, but then sprinkle more olive oil over your salad and it just adds up very easily. So if you For a learning experience, anyone listening, I highly encourage you to give that a go just for a couple of weeks, and it might be eye-opening to you. That would be one other recommendation.
Indeed. And I think that's the very first thing if people are coming to a functional medicine specialist, that we do a food diary for a week and actually truly see what are you really eating? Because in our perception, in the beautiful denial in which we often live, we think, yeah, I'm eating healthy. I must have at least a salad a day. Let me actually look at it. Yeah, about that. And even I get or got caught out in the past when I looked at my fiber intake. I realized, oh, the more I learned about nutrition, how important fiber is. And I thought, yeah, I must have been really getting great fiber. Then I looked at it and you think, oh, come on. And it's those kind of
Been
things.
there.
So don't assume, but actually get curious. Go out there and look at what is really happening. Do a reality check. And then you can work from there. And don't heap shame and guilt on you, and you think, "Oh my God, I'm failed." No, I'm a failure. I didn't even achieve that. Look at me. No, you say, "Brilliant." Now I've got a line in the sand, and now I can say, "Okay, what can I do to increase that?" And you might choose maybe to add a vegetable in there, and maybe explore the vegetables. Maybe things that you in the past never really would have touched, you suddenly realize, actually, I do like that. Brussels sprouts is not something that most people in the world would go for. But having said that, I really developed a taste for it. And so to have half a kilogram of Brussels sprouts, I have no problem with that. And I just chomp away on it, have curry powder over it and spice it up. And it's just beautiful. And it fills me up and puts a smile on my face because I've been looking after myself. I've been adding something green, cruciferous vegetables. I have been putting fiber into my body. And you know, they are probably $3.50 or something like that, in Pack and Save. I love the chicken breasts here. They are about $12 per kilogram. Whilst sort of the cheapest red meat is probably $16, $20 per kilogram. So if you're looking at money and saving money, then chicken goes a long way. And you know, if you now understand that really vegetables and lean proteins such as chicken breast are giving you a powerful head start, well, da-da, here you are.
Totally. And often we hear eating well is so expensive. But A, you pointed out some great cheap sources. And number two, they're more satiating than if you eat the same amount of money from processed food. So you're not going to feel as full for as long than if you spend that same amount of money on protein or fibrous food. So I think that's a really important factor, because if you eat your tiny little sandwich, which is ultra processed, or tiny little McDonald's burger or so, you're going to be hungry again after an hour,
Absolutely.
versus eating the same amount of money worth from a good quality protein and fiber source.
100% agreed. And when I say per kilogram, I mean to eat half a kilogram of chicken breast. That's pretty good going. Let's be just so clear, this don't go all, well, you can go all out on protein. I don't think there is too much wrong unless you have got renal disease or you've got other metabolic diseases that really maybe you want to talk to your GP first or to a nutritionist who is versed in medical illness. We know that there's only an X amount of protein that can really be utilized per meal. So instead of going all out and eating this huge mountain of protein, maybe stretch it out. Maybe stretch it out over the day and assure that you actually have that beautiful chicken breast that you prepared maybe the night before and then put it in the fridge. That was the leftover that you mentioned earlier. So here you are.
Exactly.
So if you had this beautiful roasted vegetables and then a bit of salad with it, by the time you've blinked, you can create something like 10, 12 vegetables in one meal. And those young mums out there, you often are already quite good in hiding those things because your little munchkins, they don't like necessarily certain food. I have become renowned for my, when I was younger, for my pasta sauce, tomato sauce. that I routinely made at home, but I had hidden in there probably 10 veggies, including spinach and including greens, etc. You can mix things into other things. Whilst that makes it a processed food, it has nothing wrong with that because you have created it. There are no additives in there. There is no half a ton of sugar and half a kilogram of salt hidden in there, as you normally would find in ultra-processed foods. So you actually have got probably quite a few calories in there, but these calories are healthy calories, calories that your body needs time to digest. I think that's the beautiful thing. Calorie is not calorie. So 200 calories from ultra-processed foods are very, very different compared with 200 calories that were in a mixed roasted vegetable cup bowl. So there is so much that we guys can do to live our life to the fullest. Wow. Now, it's all quite nice when we're at home, when we're in control of our environment. But what about those people who are traveling? What about those people who are living in homes where traditionally food can be very rich? Let's say indigenous people, let's say in an Indian kind of household. I'm sure there are other indigenous groups or societal groups where food traditionally has been very rich. How can we influence that where there's such a strong influence from a culture?
Yeah, you mentioned that I do travel quite frequently and have been to numerous countries myself, so I do see that firsthand, and of course also from my international clients. So first of all, when it comes to my own personal travels, I do have non-negotiables for myself. So for instance, nowadays I kind of strategically plan things around, okay, where do I know I can also be physically active? Where can I go for a hike? Where can I
Nice.
Go to a gym?
Nice.
Where that is important, because I think travel gets even more strenuous if we just deprive ourselves of movement even more than already is the case from sitting in planes and so on. So still making sure that I have access to that is really important to me. I also try to avoid nighttime travel if possible, even if it is often cheaper. Of course, if you fly long distances, like from New Zealand to Germany, it's inevitable because it takes so long. But let's just say, a shorter flight or whatever, I'm not going to pick the one that's at 3 a.m. just to save $10. But by now, I know that my health is worth more, or having a good night's sleep is worth more. And then in most cases, I think just saying that there is no other food available or whatever, and resorting to the typical convenient foods is often comes down to a lack of preparation, because A, we can often take food with us on the plane. So taking your healthier meals with you if you have possibility and you just know that there's only crap available, or thinking ahead and looking up. Nowadays, with the beauty of internet, we know that there are restaurants in our vicinity, and we can look up specific things that we want to, as opposed to just wandering around. And so preparation and planning go a really far way. And in most instances, when you land somewhere, you just look up where is the first supermarket, you stock up your mini fridge in the hotel or Airbnb that you're at. And I still allow myself to have one, or it depends on how long I stay somewhere, one meal a day or so where I eat out. I don't want to eat out all the time, because again, even if it's healthier choices like a salad or so, usually the salad dressing or whatever is a little bit more laden with things that we don't necessarily want. So I still try or feel my best if the majority of the foods, or two, three of my meals per day, I prepare myself, and then I allow myself to have one meal out. Now, if we're talking more about like longer term nutritional challenges, let's say working with someone in India or something like that, or even here, home cooked meals are a little bit different. You have your rice with everything all the time and so on. The first thing I do say, well, as a coach, I have had to learn to accept that culture and emotional eating that we were talking about earlier, emotional eating in the sense of cultural eating rather than just impulsive eating, I do need to have some respect for it. So telling someone in the Philippines, oh, you can never ever have rice again because you're complaining that you're hungry on your diet, just switch your rice for potato because it's more satiating, they're going to be like, I don't like potatoes just because you're German and you like potatoes. I'm not going to eat potatoes. I want to have my rice. So working around that and being like, okay, can we, instead of having rice 3 times per day, can we just have it in your dinner? Is that okay? Yeah, okay, that works. Or to the Indian person, maybe saying, instead of choosing the super extra creamy ghee and coconut cream filled whatever curry, can we maybe go for some tandoori chicken or tandoori fish? So working with the culture, educating myself as a coach about the culture and whatever is sort of like a given there. And that's become or been very important. Most cultures do have some kind of protein source. Most cultures do have some kind of vegetables. It's just finding out what is available there. In the Middle East, you might not necessarily find the freshest asparagus, but maybe you can find some frozen spinach or some other green vegetables that they have over there. So
Correct.
yeah, preparation, planning, they go really a long way also for those kind of, for the clients worldwide.
That's beautiful the way you said that, because there are actually ways around it. And one of it is being curious about how food is really prepared. For example, if we were to look at butter chicken is an Indian dish that is outside of India, actually very, very, delicious, and people want to have it. And people in India say, butter chicken, what the hell is that? When you actually, I spoke to a restaurant owner, a little old lady who was running an Indian restaurant, and she taught me how to cook some of the dishes. And it's actually interesting when you look behind the butter chicken, there's actually not much butter, there's no butter in there. And you can actually, once you understand the influences of various spices and various cooking methods, etc., on your end result, you can tweak those recipes from actually maybe not so good to actually don't worry about it. You can be virtually guilt-free with those kind of things. So be curious and don't just accept something because someone said, oh, that's healthy or that's not healthy. Just look at it. Look at it under the circumstances of your own life and say, okay, maybe this is a bit of richer food, but then again, maybe I put in a workout just prior to that, have a shower, calm down a bit, and then enjoy this beautiful food that is richer, but I've actually minimized the impact, the negative impact of it, and I can now appreciate the positive impact that those things that are good in it, however rich they are, it my body will love it because I have opened up the muscles. I've opened up metabolic pathways that are now saying, "Oh yeah, thank you very much. I need that extra fat." Perfect. Absolutely perfect. So let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. Let's be curious about life and let's look at it in its most beautiful version. And I want to come back to the way we are living our life, because when we are so absent-minded, when we are running around like crazy, full of stress, totally worry, it's such a destructive lifestyle. Yet when we actually put micro pauses in, and I've learned, I forced myself actually to create those micro pauses around food that I actually try not to read whilst I'm eating. I'm trying not to do that. And I say I try because actually for me, it's so beautiful to switch off. So I'm still finding myself scrolling while I'm eating. I need to key thing is actually be mindful, appreciate
Yeah, absolutely.
the
It is.
food for the gift that it is to our life, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, such a good point in terms of slowing down. But yeah, if we eat while watching TV or scrolling or so, the research does support that we're not actually, the satiation feeling is not setting in as quickly. And we're not realizing what we're actually eating if we're not taking or using all our senses. And I encourage my clients, or just in general, try to practice as well, just to take a couple of deep breaths before doing it. It doesn't have to be
For
like
sure.
a full breath work session or anything extreme, but literally just sitting down, looking at your food, and just thinking thanks for the food, whoever, and taking 2, 3 deep breaths so that you're like fully present. I have plenty of cl clients that get out of the habit of eating in front of their desk, their laptop or whatever at their desk, and that's just something that's really not conducive to a proper satiation signals.
I just had a brain spark there that actually that little moment of prayer before food can actually have a very meaningful impact.
Oh,
I've never
definitely. That's
considered, I've ne I'm an atheist, so I don't pray, but
not there.
here you are, so maybe there is something to be said about that. And equally, maybe your mom was right when she said, "Come on, don't get your food down, as inhale it like a Hoover, but rather actually chew it 40 times." And maybe there's something to be said about that. So, no, that's wonderful. Oh, Lisa, you're an amazing woman. This was so fun to explore those various avenues of us living our life to the fullest. And food is
And thank
medicine.
you so much, yeah, for having me. Honestly, it's been I've truly enjoyed our conversation as well. And I agree. I mean, it is my mission to truly show people that food enriches our lives and doesn't mean that it should be something that should bring us worry or that should make us feel worse. It enriches our lives. So yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's been a true
Oh,
pleasure.
absolutely. Lisa, if people want to work with you, if want to find you, want to see what you're all about, where can they find you?
Yeah, so the name of my company is Nutrition Coaching and Life, and that's also the name of my Instagram page where I'm most active on. I'm also on LinkedIn or YouTube, and the name of my podcast is the Nutrition and Life Podcast. So anywhere under Nutrition Coaching and Life, you'll find me.
Fantastic. Guys, look down there into the description of the YouTube video and of the podcast. You will find lots of information there, including Lisa's links. So what have you got to lose? You can start from scratch and try to reinvent the wheel, or maybe you get in touch with people who maybe have been there before, have now come a bit further down the path than you. Always surround yourself with people who are further advanced than you. Always be the dumbest member of your team, because that's the way how you grow. So, and I think there is so much to be said about having a nutritional coach, to having education and motivation and being held accountable. I think there are so many aspects that come into the coaching field, which are beautiful. So it is, we all have a life to live, and the more we can show up for ourselves, the more we can then be role models for others, be our best self. And if you are a leader, then this is, I think, the biggest investment that you can do into the balance of activity and appropriate nutrition. Because with that, you get yourself most sustainable and become the best version of yourself. So, Lisa, you're an amazing woman. Thank you so much for being a guest on my show.
Thank you.
And you guys out there, look after yourself and live with intention. Bye.